Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is biographer Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. He's joined in conversation by CNN's Holly Furfer. And now join Holly Furfer as she introduces Walter Isaacson.
Welcome. We are in for such a fascinating evening tonight with international best-selling author Walter Isaacson. We're going to talk about his latest book, The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. Walter Isaacson is a professor of history at Tulane, and he has been CEO of the Aspen Institute, chair of CNN, and editor of Time. He has authored many incredible books, including Leonardo da Vinci, The Innovators, Steve Jobs, Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and Kissinger, a biography. And he's the co-author of The Wise Men, Six Friends, and The World They Made. So please welcome our very special guest this evening, Mr. Walter Isaacson.
Hey, Holly. Thank you so much for having me. Boy, it's great to be back with y'all.
So good to have you here. This book, it is long. It is comprehensive. I do think I have a PhD now from reading it. But for those who haven't read it yet, just give us an overview of what they'll get from The Codebreaker.
This is about a wonderful woman named Jennifer Doudna. You've heard of her because she just won the Nobel Prize, which, by the way, was lucky for the book. I was staying up all night when they were about to announce it. And she's somebody who grew up in Hilo, Hawaii, and she read The Double Helix when she was in middle school because her dad left it on the bed. And she thought, oh, this looks like a detective story. And when she read it, she realized it was kind of a detective story. It was Jim Watson's tale about how he and Francis Crick, using the images from Rosalind Franklin, discover the structure of DNA, the secret of life. And so she says, I want to become a scientist like that. And her school guidance counselor said, well, no, girls don't become scientists. But, you know, she persisted, and she did. And she made the greatest discovery of our lifetime, which is, how can you edit our genes? And it's called CRISPR. And it's something bacteria have been doing for a billion years. So it isn't all that difficult. All it is a guide that takes a scissors, meaning an enzyme, and says, here, cut the DNA in this place. And she was able to figure out with a research partner named Emmanuel Charpentier exactly how to make it into a tool that can edit our genes. And then after that, they've turned their attention to COVID, because the guide that bacteria use and that CRISPR uses and that Jennifer used is RNA, that sort of sibling of DNA that actually does the work. It actually goes and builds proteins in our cell. And you've heard of RNA because I know we were talking about the vaccines just a few moments ago. RNA is the messenger that's used in the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And it's a guide that Jennifer used when she created this gene editing technology. And that's going to be the technology of our time that we're going to have to wrestle with most, because there's some moral issues there, like how much you're allowed to edit your children. I know, let's not get started. Some of us would have some edits we might want to make. But also, such great promise, because it will help us get out of future virus attacks. It will help us destroy genetic diseases like Tay-Sachs and sickle cell anemia. And it's going to really help us edit the human race to be healthier, and if we're wise, you know, to be a stronger race.
There's so much in there. So that was a good overview. Let's start unpacking a little bit. So the way I looked at this book, it's sort of in thirds is the way I read it. The first, you talk really about the history of genetics, right? So give us a little bit, because you go into Watson and Crick and even Darwin and talk about how they discovered that, you know, how we're made up, and then the Human Genome Project, right? So talk a little bit about doing the research. So you kind of walk us through that in the beginning.
Yes. I mean, I'll go way back, which is the books I've written are about the three fundamental kernels of our existence, the atom, the bit, which is binary digits that store information, and the gene. And around 1900, we kind of figure out those particles. Now, I wrote about Einstein to do the physics revolution. Steve Jobs was the one about the digital revolution, the second half of the 20th century. And now we're starting to be able not only to understand the gene, but rewrite the gene. And the history you're talking about begins in the 1850s when Charles Darwin writes On the Origin of Species. And this monk named Gregor Mendel, you know, he's breeding peas, and he starts to notice, oh, they have inherited traits. So from the beaks of Darwin's finches to the properties of Mendel's peas, we come up with this notion that there's some particle, some entity that is the kernel that hands down our genetic information. And eventually it turns out to be this nucleic acid, you know, just some molecule in our system called DNA. And when we talk about Watson and Crick, they figured out the structure of DNA. It has, you know, four letters. And that means it's like a coding machine and just like a microchip, but it's a molecule. And so with those four letters, there's 3 billion pairs of them in our human genome. And that codes, you know, that I get gray hair at a certain point. It codes how tall I'm going to be. It codes all my genetic information. But the thing about it is, around 2000, we were able to sequence the human gene. As you said, Holly, that's called the Human Genome Project. Not everybody thought that was pretty amazing. I was at Time Magazine. We put it on the cover of Time Magazine. But the thing is, that really didn't do much. All we got to do was read the genes. You can go to 23andMe and put a little saliva in a tube, and they'll tell you what genes you have. The important thing is being able to rewrite those genes when there's a bad problem. And that's what Jennifer Doudna did with this gene editing tool called CRISPR.
Right. So the Human Genome Project sort of laid the map, the roadmap down. And now she sort of was one of those many that you talk about in the book that spearheaded and found that route to actually gene editing. So in the book, you get very detailed, so it's really comprehensive, but if you can sort of walk us through, because I think CRISPR is a little confusing to people because you're talking about DNA, but messenger RNA, mRNA, and you're talking about proteins. Mm-hmm. So sort of give us the layman's version, if you don't mind, of sort of laying out what's in the science behind it.
Yeah, CRISPR is really easy because bacteria, they've been doing it for 1 billion years, right? And they're not much smarter than we are. And what they do is they take a mugshot of any virus that attacks them, which means they take a snippet of the genetic code and they weave it into their own DNA. And so they have these clustered, repeated sequences that contain, you know, the DNA of any virus that attacked them. And those clustered, repeated sequences get called CRISPR. And so that's all it really is a way for bacteria to remember viruses that attack. Now, that doesn't seem all that interesting unless you get into a virus pandemic like we are in now, and you realize, okay, that's a pretty useful thing to be able to do. And so what bacteria do with it is they say, all right, if I notice such a virus attacking me again, just like we have vaccines that say, okay, I notice that's attacking me again, what CRISPR does in bacteria is it has a scissors, like an enzyme, that's guided by a little piece of RNA. And when it sees the virus coming again, it just chops it up. And all that Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier, and that group who created the gene editing tool did said, well, if bacteria can use it to cut a virus, we can repurpose it and target it to cut genes in our own body. So what they did was repurpose this system that bacteria have been using for 1 billion or so years and said, we can then program the guide, program that RNA guide so that it goes after one of our own genes, chops it up, and we can replace the gene if we want to. So that's all it is. It's not really all that complicated. I was able to do it in the lab in one day.
Yeah, I read you put in there your journey about how you were able to do it. I thought that was pretty incredible.
Don't worry, we flushed it all down the drain with chlorine. So whatever I edited will not be part of the human race.
Be part of history. We will never know. And so you talk about you have messenger RNA, and then there's CRISPR RNA, and you talk about tracer RNA. So there's different types without getting too much into the weeds.
But they're all RNA. You have little snippets of it. And so a messenger RNA is the fundamental thing that RNA does. You know, everybody knows about DNA. It's the famous one. But like a lot of famous siblings, it really doesn't do much work. DNA just sits there in the nucleus of our cells and curates the information in our genes. What messenger RNA does is it's just a messenger. It takes some of that information that's in our DNA, and it goes to the outer region of a cell, which is where there's the manufacturing plant to make proteins. And it says, okay, I've read this part of the DNA, this, you know, genetic sequence, make this protein. And so when we use messenger RNA for a vaccine, we simply code it to make a part of the spike protein of the coronavirus. That's what the mRNA vaccines do. It goes to the manufacturing region of our cell and makes fragments of that horrible spike protein. Why? Because then our immune system sees it, says that's not supposed to be around, and our immune system is prepared the next time it sees a spike protein. It'll kill it. And that's how we prevent coronavirus. So that's messenger RNA. And a similar snippet of RNA can serve as a guide. That's called a guide RNA. And that's the guide in the CRISPR system that takes the enzyme and says, I want you to cut the genetic material here at this gene. And so whether you call it CRISPR RNA or guide RNA or messenger RNA, it's still that four-letter nucleic acid called RNA, and it scurries around and it cuts things up and it builds proteins.
Got it. In the way you explained it, it makes so much sense. Like, now I get it. So you do talk about in the beginning and in the end, you get into COVID-19, the pandemic we're in. First of all, I want to ask you just sort of a behind the scenes. So when you were writing this book, because you wrote this way, you started this way before we even knew what COVID-19 was. So how were you able to encapsulate all of that? Because pretty much the whole back half of the, you know, the back part of the book at the end is talking about the whole idea of, you know, genetic editing and COVID-19 and future viruses.
When I embarked on this book, I thought biotechnology was the most important thing going on right now. And it was filled with really colorful characters like Jennifer Doudna and Fong Zhang and George Church, Emmanuel Sharp and Jay, and that they were heroes, not heroes who wore capes, but heroes who wore lab coats. When COVID hit, I thought, wow, I've been underestimating how important this is. Because all of those things that they do, we had to deploy in our fight against COVID. So I was, you know, halfway through researching the book, but the book sort of then proceeds to Jennifer Doudna one day, this is exactly a year ago, meaning the beginning of March of last year, and she put her son Andy on the bus from Berkeley, on the train actually, to go to Fresno to one of those robot building competitions that juniors in high school get to go to. And then she was hearing how the Berkeley campus was shutting down because of COVID. So at about 2 a.m, she wakes up her husband, Jamie, says, get in the car. We're going to have to go pick up Andy at this camp. Now, he's an only child. Now, so you can expect he's rolling his eyes. He's pretty upset when his parents are yanking him away. But what happens is, as they're driving out of the parking lot, they all get a text that says, robot competition canceled. All kids should go home. And that's when she said she gets back to Berkeley, and the next day she convenes 50 scientists from the Bay Area and says, all right, put down the research of whatever you're doing, grab your pipettes and your test tube. We're going to break into teams and we're going to start fighting the coronavirus. So it was a perfect segue in my book. As you know, the book begins with that, her picking up her kid. And then the last section of the book is, okay, how are we going to fight this coronavirus?
And what's interesting is then Moderna, from what I understand, Moderna and Pfizer, their process of the vaccine is just like this gene editing. They're using a version of this.
They're using messenger RNA, as you said, and that's using RNA as a way to build what we call an antigen, meaning a protein that stimulates our immune system. It's not the exact same as CRISPR, but it's just using RNA as a little guide or a tool or a messenger to say, do this with protein. But there are other things that Jennifer Doudna did, not just making the vaccine, but she and her rivals, the guys at MIT and Harvard, are making these easy at-home testing kits you'll be getting in a few months that use this system of CRISPR to say, okay, I can spot any genetic material that comes along. So just with a little, you know, you spit into a test tube, like a home pregnancy test, but you just put it in the thing, and if it glows, it means you've been exposed to the coronavirus. Or you can test for the flu or strep throat or bacterial infection, or do your gut microbiome. So this is going to bring biology home. So it's not just about vaccines. We talk about vaccines. I mean, that's a big deal this month. But having really rapid tests and then having really good treatments, because bacteria, that's what they use CRISPR for. They get infected with a virus. They treat it. They kill it. So what these technologies do and what Jennifer Doudna's team does is say, let's not just worry about this vaccine for this coronavirus, because it's going to mutate. We're going to have variants. We need to know how to fight every wave of virus pandemic. We need a lot of weapons. We need detection tools. We need cures. We need treatments. We need vaccines.
Now, let me talk about, in a big section, we'll talk. You mentioned the rivalry, and it's interesting because, you know, even in science, there's that rivalry between Jennifer and Feng Jing's labs, and you know, it's a friendly rivalry because in a lot of ways, too, they know what they're doing is going to benefit humanity. It's good science. But talk a little bit about that, because there's so many people involved, even George Church, who is also a big player in this, but they all are different places, but they all sort of interconnect. They've worked with each other. It seems like a big community, almost like a family where there's love-hate going on.
Yeah, we all know it very well. Any business we're in, any job we're in, any family we're in, maybe even any synagogue we're in, we know that there's rivalries, and we know that there's competition, and we know that there's cooperation and collaboration, and life is a mix of this. The interesting thing in my book is that you say it was a friendly rivalry when they were pursuing genetic editing in CRISPR. It was sort of friendly, but they were suing each other. They're fighting over the patents. It was a pretty rough rivalry.
Yeah.
It got friendlier when they said, okay, let's all turn our attention to COVID. And that was why it was interesting to me, because sometimes we compete really hard and we've got rivalries. But then we get faced with something bigger. It's like Ronald Reagan used to say, you know, we can have a lot of rivalries between countries, but if an alien civilization attacked us, we'd all cooperate and fight. Well, that's what happened. This was almost like an alien civilization, this virus. And so it took the team at Berkeley, you know, with Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, and the team around Feng Zhang, George Church, and others at Harvard, and it sort of nudged them back to cooperation. And it reminded everybody of why they're doing this. It's the nobility of science to help humanity, not just a race for patents and Nobel Prizes.
You're listening to biographer Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. He's joined in conversation by journalist Holly Furfer on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And let's talk too about, so the big elephant in the room for everybody with CRISPR is the ethics behind it. You know, we talk about gene editing, and there's a big gray area in there. So you talk about how it pretty much can cure sickle cell anemia, certain diseases. Wouldn't it be great if you knew you had Alzheimer's in the family and you could edit out a gene in your children to know that they would never suffer from Alzheimer's or anything like that. But then we sort of cross that line of, you know, people think of that, they think eugenics, the Nazis, Hitler, creating the perfect race, because where does it stop? Address that, if you will, because that is something that I think fascinates people and frightens people as well.
A year or so after Jennifer Doudna made the discovery of the gene editing technology, she had a nightmare. And it was that somebody said, come into the room. I want you to meet somebody who wants to understand your technology. She goes into the room, and it's Hitler. And so she said she couldn't sleep for nights after that. So she gathers groups of scientists from around the world, the Chinese Academy of Science in Russia and the Royal Academy in England and the National Academies here and in the, in Europe. And they start a process to say, when are we going to use this technology? Because we all know we want to use it for good. We want to get rid of these horrible genetic diseases, you know, like sickle cell and Tay-Sachs and Huntington's. And we may even want to do it. A Chinese scientist edited the embryos of babies to make inheritable edits, which is sort of crossing a line to make it so that it's not just for the patient, but it'll be inherited by all their children, but did it because wanted to make the patient and the children and the descendants immune from the virus that causes AIDS. Well, that caused a lot of consternation, but nowadays when we're facing virus pandemics, maybe we do want to edit the human race that way. But you talk about editing, say, because somebody's got genes that could lead to a disposition to Alzheimer's. Yeah, that could be done someday. But if you can do that, you can also make edits so people have better memory. Now, be careful with what you wish for. I'm kind of lucky. I don't have a very good memory. I forget all the slights or anything that happened to me. In fact, I just read a book saying we're all pretty lucky if we have bad memory. But you could say, I want my kid to be smarter, so I'm going to give my kid better memory and better processing power. So that's when you get into a murky area. Do we want to let the rich people buy better genes for their kids? Do we want to edit out the diversity in our society? You know, if you had a very private fertility clinic and nobody was watching what you chose, you know, what traits would you pick? Tall? Would you pick, you know, hair color, sexual, you know, orientation, all those things? Well, if everybody does that, maybe we'll start editing out some of the things that make our species rather flavorful and diverse. So that's a bad thing.
How do you, so you mentioned He Jinghua, the Chinese scientist who edited out the gene for HIV.
And Holly, I'm giving you a lot of credit. You pronounce everybody's name right. Very good.
I'm trying. I'm trying.
CNN person.
See, you trained us well. And, but, you know, there was an agreement among scientists before he did this that they would, you know, the first time they used it on a sickle cell patient, it was a woman who was in her 40s. She wasn't going to have children. It would cure her, but wouldn't change a genetic line or, like you said, the inherited gene. And it seemed that there was sort of a gentleman's agreement among scientists. And then this researcher, scientist, goes and changes, you know, the embryos, and everybody just says, whoa, wait a minute. So how do you prevent that? I mean, once the genie's out of the bottle, you really can't put it back in.
Right. And it's hard to prevent or have rules of the road for the use of CRISPR, because as I said, even I could do it in a university biology lab with two graduate students helping me. It's not like making an atom bomb, which is, you know, something you can't do in your own basement or garage. So it's going to be hard to regulate this technology. But we do regulate drugs. We do regulate with the FDA and medical procedures. And there are things we can't stop, but we say, no, that's shameful. And no, we have laws against it, whether it's shoplifting or sex trafficking or elephant tusks or, you know, whatever it may be. There's still going to be some shoplifters. But you can say this is something that the humans should not be able to do, which is, and we can set the rules. For me, the rules would be pretty simple. We could use this technology for things that are clearly medically necessary and where there aren't good alternatives. But when it comes to enhancements, no. We should all be subject to a natural lottery. Now, you're right. one of the things that's easy to edit is muscle mass. And we have a myostatin in our system, and you regulate that, you could have more muscle mass. So everybody's going to be just like people tried to use steroids, and, you know, Mark McGwire hit home runs because of it. Yeah, there'll be people trying to game the system a bit. But I think that that doesn't mean we should throw up our hands. It means we should say, what do we approve of and what do we don't approve of?
What do you do with other countries? You know, there's always those bad actors. There's always our adversaries who may not have our best interest in at heart, or science at interest at heart. So how do you regulate that? I mean, is there even a way to do it, or do you have to be prepared for anything?
Well, that's what Jennifer Doudna did with these international summits. In fact, everybody met in Hong Kong after the Chinese scientist did what he did. And China's aboard. The Chinese scientist who did that is under house arrest and, you know, has been sentenced to at least 3 years, you know, for unauthorized scientific experiments. And you try to enlist through the WHO, the World Health Organization, and others, countries around the world, to just like we have agreements on everything from drugs to nuclear weapons. But you're right, it's not going to be perfect, nor is the nuclear weapon regime. And people fly to Mexico maybe to get unauthorized drug treatments for things. But you can try to be like Jennifer Doudna and say, let's get scientists around the world to agree that at least for the foreseeable future, we won't make inheritable edits, and we won't make edits that are, except for ones that are medically necessary.
Now, let me ask you, I think there's sort of, when we talk about that gray area, you know, we vaccinate people, right? We'll vaccinate people every year so they don't get the flu. We'll vaccinate people for pneumonia. We vaccinated people for polio and basically eradicated polio. What's the difference in doing it after somebody's born or before somebody's born if we want to get rid of some of these terrible diseases like we did with polio?
Well, the most important difference is if you do it in reproductive cells, meaning early stage embryos or eggs or sperm, then it means that as the child grows, every cell in his or her body has been edited because it's done in the early stage of an embryo or something. So it becomes part of it. And it means even the child's reproductive cells have those edits. So that means the edit doesn't just affect the one child, it affects all future generations. And so that's why that's a line we have to be a little bit more careful before we cross. Now, there are reasons you may want to do germline editing. You know, as you said, a woman was cured of sickle cell anemia down in Mississippi, you know, just a few months ago using CRISPR. But that cost $1 million. You had to take all the blood cells and the stem cells out and edit them and put them back in the body. If you edited sickle cell anemia or Tay-Sachs or other things out of the human species, and you did it in reproductive cells, so nobody ever inherited the mutations that cause those diseases, that's something that's very, very cheap and it lasts forever. So that's a reason why you might say, maybe we should do inheritable gene edits, but that's the type of discussion we have to have as a society, because this is a really good technology. We want to use this, but we should all, and that's why I wrote this book, so that people can say, okay, I see what it is, and over dinner, or I don't want to cede this to the scientists. I don't want to cede it just to the politicians. I want all of us to be thinking, you know, should we do this?
And what is the chances, though? I mean, obviously, you had mentioned it earlier, how you this disparity between who can do gene editing and have maybe their, you know, embryos perfected and, you know, editing out diseases, and those who can't afford it. As you mentioned, that sickle cell treatment was about $1 million. Now, obviously, computers are very expensive when it first started, and obviously things, you know, get less expensive, but still, are you creating sort of the have and have nots, and that gap is just getting bigger because of this?
Yeah, and we've seen that in science fiction. That's what Brave New World is all about, creating the two classes of society. You know, it was written, whatever, 80, 90 years ago, and that's what the movie Gattaca is about. And yes, if we have these choices to make gene edits at a genetic supermarket, they're not going to be free. And so do you want to allow rich people to buy better genes? We already have inequality in our society, but that would exacerbate it, and it would even encode it so that we had, you know, a species and subspecies, the edited and non-edited. So that's a nightmare scenario. And that's where I think we'd all agree we don't want to go there.
And even, you know, you talk about medical care costs, though, today. So if somebody does have sickle cell anemia or Tay-Sachs or some of these, you know, cystic fibrosis, these diseases that are very costly and they're chronic, though, would it sort of balance itself out? Because eventually, if you don't have to suffer from that, you don't have those medical bills. It may be sort of, you know, something that insurance companies might even be willing to.
Oh, yeah.
To put in.
I mean, the whole promise here is that this is going to be great. If you could, you know, make a dent in Alzheimer's, that's a really costly thing to society, emotionally and financially. Likewise, as you said, these chronic diseases, whether it be sickle cell, Tay-Sachs, Huntington's, whatever. So, yes, if we can edit them out of the species, this will save us a lot of money. And the tricky thing is, the thing that really saves money is if you edit it in reproductive cells so that we get rid of it once and for all. And people say, well, there might be, you know, we're messing with Mother Nature. Well, Mother Nature and, you know, God and nature's God gave us the tools, whether it be vaccines or, you know, whatever tools, so that we can stand up to natural phenomena that are dangerous to us. So I don't think we should sort of say we aren't going to use these tools.
And we talk a lot about physical maladies, physical ailments, but what about psychological? We know people are, you know, bipolar, schizophrenia. Would that help with this as well? And should it help?
Yes. I mean, these are complicated things because there's no single gene for, say, schizophrenia or manic depressiveness. But we know that certain genes predispose people to certain things, including schizophrenia. And James Watson, who's become rather problematic because after discovering DNA, you know, he treads in that bad area of eugenics and race and everything else. But he sees everything through a genetic lens, and partly because he has a son who's very problematically schizophrenic. And so he says, all right, that's my goal in life, to edit genes or to understand genes so I can understand schizophrenia. Now, clearly, schizophrenia is a very, and so is, you know, manic depression, you know, very debilitating disease. But it's a little bit dangerous in, say, the next few decades, I think it'll be dangerous to say we can edit out that disposition. Because those genes are very complicated. And frankly, if you look at somebody like Jim Watson, you know, the father, he had a lot of the traits too, but it also made him a good scientist. If you look at Hemingway or Vincent van Gogh, people who were, you know, had depression or schizophrenia, it also, if you look at Miles Davis, you know, who had sickle cell anemia, these things lead to certain creativity in our species, but also great suffering. So this is something we don't want to go barreling down a slippery slope, because you can have a lot of unintended consequences, especially when you get into editing psychological disorders. That said, just as we use drugs and other therapies to help with psychological illnesses, including schizophrenia, if we found ways to use CRISPR that were safe and effective, I think, yeah, we'd want to do that.
How much do we know that we don't know? So when they cured sickle cell, we know now that sickle cell can help those who had sickle cell would not get malaria, that it was part of the genetic right. makeup. But that if you go ahead and change that, now all of a sudden there's some unintended consequences that you're changing one thing, but you may be creating another problem. Do we even know you know, where this might go with all the genes? I mean, we know we can fix some things, but do we know what the consequences might be?
You know, that's a really good question. And obviously you've read the book because that's a question scientists in the book are wrestling with, including West Nile and virus and malaria, et cetera. We don't know all the consequences of tinkering with genes, but we know a lot. I mean, we've sequenced the human gene. And one thing you can always do is say, at least now we'll have a rule, which is you can't make edits that create the type of genes or genome that don't already exist within the population. So in other words, if you're taking out a gene that causes sickle cell, you then have a resulting genome of the person, and that's a genome that's identical to millions of other people. And so we can do this step by step carefully, but it's why we don't want people barreling down doing these things before we say, let's make sure that if you cure this, you don't cause that.
So the book is, I mean, it's close to 500 pages and it's so detailed. How long did it take you to research this, to get to wrap your head around it, and then to write it and then update it? Because this is fluid. I mean, as you
mentioned, it only took about 4 or 5 years. And frankly, it's the shortest of all of my books. If you just get to the narrative part, you know, it's not that long because it's a narrative. It's about a person. It's not a science book. It's not a textbook. And so it's about Jennifer Doudna and all of her friends. And yeah, I try to smuggle in some of the science, but the reason it's, you know, close to 500 as opposed to 400 pages is that, well, we hit the coronavirus. And so let me tell that story too.
It was great. Okay, so let me get to some questions here for you. Let me start with Karen Steinberg. And she says, have off-target mutations been a problem at all? And have they happened?
Yes, that's a very good question. It's off target when you try to do an edit and the CRISPR or the editing tool hits another target. That's a problem, but it's a problem that's a scientifically understandable one and is being solved. The question, the only case we have of reproductive of a embryo being done is He Zhuangqi, the Chinese scientist we talked about. And the babies he designed, so to speak, are about 2.5 years old now, and they're being monitored. There was some indication that there was some off-target edits, but we don't really know much, and it doesn't seem like it was bad. I think that's a smart question because it is a problem, but it's a solvable problem. It's a problem where you can, there's a guy, David Liu at Harvard, who is doing, he's got a Beam Therapeutics, and he's doing it's called base editing and other prime editing. And these are ways of making sure you get the target right.
And Karen, I don't know if Karen's in research and science, but she said, who finally got the patent for CRISPR?
Well, that's a good question. We don't, it's still fighting. And I wish I tried to get them to shake hands and make up like the people at Intel did with Texas Instruments on the microchip patent. The short answer is, the patent office, in its infinite wisdom, has given patents to both sides, and they overlap. Feng Zhang and the Broad Institute got patents first, but now Berkeley and its team has gotten patents, and they've gone through a whole round of patent interference cases, and now they've got another one. It's like, who was first to, you know, get certain things right? You know, I think it's been a boon for patent lawyers, but I actually think this has gone on too long. Both the Feng Zhang team at the Broad and Jennifer Doudna's team at Berkeley have both done amazing work. They both have patents that are rather valid, and they should cross-license each other's patents and throw in the towel on fighting each other.
Were you surprised that Doudna won the Nobel and Emmanuel, they won the Nobel Prize and it wasn't given to George Church and Feng Zhang on the other side? I mean, it wasn't for all of them?
That's a really good question. I got up at 4 a.m., sort of had trouble sleeping because I wanted to see the live feed. And I thought it might be given to CRISPR. And if you had made me bet, you could only get three people. So it would have had to been Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier, and I would have bet Feng Zhang would have been the third, all the participants in the patent battle. But when they announced it, I'm holding my breath, and it was just given to the two women. Jennifer slept through it. I remember calling her a couple of hours later, and she had been sound asleep. I mean, I don't know how she could have been sound asleep. I would have been staying up. But I think it's important not only that it got the Nobel, but if you read that citation, it's not like normal Nobel prizes, like this discovery is really good or whatever. It says this brings science into an entirely new epoch. I mean, it changes everything. And that's what the Nobel citation said.
And do you make this equivalent to, you talked about even in the 21st century, 20th century, the advent of technology and computers. And this is this our new technology of the 21st century? Is this where we're going with that, seeing this take over?
Yeah. And by the way, you know, I wrote a whole book about the digital technology and the great invention, which I have right here, which we all have, is, you know, our iPhones. This is going to be a lot more consequential even than the iPhone, is this notion of being able to edit our genes.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is biographer Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. He's joined in conversation by journalist Holly Furfer. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
Let me ask you this one from Barbie. She says, can you comment on the difference between germline and somatic editing?
Germline and somatic. And that's what we've been talking about. Yeah. Germline means it's inheritable. It means you're doing it in reproductive cells, as we talked about, as the Chinese scientists did. Somatic is just another word for in the body. And so when we talk about Victoria Gray, the woman who got cured of sickle cell, that was somatic. It was done in that one patient in her body cells, meaning her stem cells in her blood, whereas the embryos in China were germline, which means they go down through all the descendants of that person because they affect every cell in the body.
Teresa Wilson says, most of your biographies are about men. Did Doudna's gender make any difference in the research storyline or have an impact on you? And that leads to the question, because there are so many people. You mentioned George Church, Feng Zhang. There's so many people who were a part of this. Why Jennifer?
Well, they deserve their own biographies. I'm sure Feng Zhang will get one. And George Church is like a brilliant scientist disguised as a madman. He's bringing back a woolly mammoth using DNA. So he's a good biography subject too. But I wanted to do somebody who gave me a way into all of the elements of this new revolution. And Jennifer Doudna, when I first started talking to her 5 or 6 years ago, I realized she's the one who, having read the double helix about the structure of DNA, figures out the structure of certain types of RNA. Not only the RNA we talked about in messengers and guides and that sort of thing, but self-replicating RNA. In other words, RNA that can replicate itself. And when she figures out how that works, that answers one of the greatest of all questions, which is, how did life begin on this planet? It's because RNA and that stew of chemicals and, you know, 4 billion years ago started replicating itself. So her story is not just about the CRISPR tale. It's about RNA. It's about women in science, which is important because women have been written out of the history of science too much. It's about gene editing. It's about fighting coronavirus. And it's about enlisting other scientists to wrestle with the moral issues. So that's what made her, to me, the perfect narrative central character. And she's a good person, too.
Mickey Goodman says, this is such a complex topic. Can you describe your process of writing about Jennifer and her work? We know you said it took about 3-4 years, but how do you go about taking all this information and putting it to paper where it makes sense? And you kind of took us on a discovery journey of us with you.
Yeah. Well, that was intentional, and thank you for saying that, because it is a journey of discovery, meaning I go hand in hand with Jennifer Doudna, and I explain the discovery of how RNA can replicate itself, the discovery of how you can make a gene editing tool. And so when you organize it that way, as a chronological narrative with a central character, you're able to say, hey, come with me hand in hand as Jennifer discovers these things, as I learn these things. And then I'm sort of in the book sometimes because I'm learning these things, and I hope it makes it a journey of discovery for the reader. So I always do it in the simplest way, the way the Bible does it, which is, let's, you know, Adam and Eve and Moses and whatever. You have a central character, you tell a narrative story, and that helps explain the moral issues and the other issues.
And I'll say some of your asides in there made me laugh out loud. So because I was thinking the same thing and you would just say it for me.
Well, you know, when you're doing science like that, occasionally you have to make sure people can laugh.
Exactly. Belinda says, why is it worse if the gene change for HIV is transferable to your children?
Yeah, why is it bad to make inheritable edits, especially when it's an edit you'd kind of like, I don't want my kids to have the receptor for HIV, and I don't want any of my descendants to ever get AIDS. And George Church says that after we were all wringing our hands saying, oh, they've made an inheritable edit. And George Church says, I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't want to have the receptor for HIV. And he said, I don't see anything wrong with adding a few IQ points to everybody. So you have to pause and say, maybe this isn't so bad. And maybe the bad thing, the thing that would be lacking in morality, is to not use it, to not protect children from HIV. So if it were safe, and if we knew there were no unintended consequences, then we knew that we could do it carefully without off-target mutations, yeah, my own ethical thinking changed throughout this book. Because at first, I was horrified. And then I sat on the balcony behind me overlooking Royal Street here in New Orleans, and the coronavirus had hit, and I said, wait a minute, why wouldn't we use a tool, you know, to get rid of really bad things like sickle cell, but also to make us a little bit less immune to virus attack? And then I said, bacteria have been doing it for a billion years. They don't feel guilty about having this system that protects them from virus attacks. So yeah, that's a really good question, which is, after everybody flails their arms and says, we shouldn't be doing this, then you have to say, why not?
And like we mentioned earlier with vaccines, the point of, you know, we were able to eradicate polio by vaccinating everybody. And that took a long time. And that was, even now, look at our vaccine issue with COVID-19. Wouldn't it be great if it could be stopped in the beginning and not have to go through?
Yeah, or anything. If we had systems within our body that we could that could attack foreign substances that were bad, including cancerous cells that were from tumors. You know, that's what CRISPR can do. And that's why I said what Jennifer Doudna and others are working on is not just a better vaccine, but let's figure out ways where we don't have to be susceptible to viruses. They're no smarter than we are. They're barely a living creature.
And that leads to the question Stan Scopit has. He says, you didn't mention anything about editing out specific types of cancer cells. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, China is ahead of us doing cancer, and they're doing it at the University of Pennsylvania, where it's not just editing out cancer cells. What you're able to do is, like we do with immunotherapy, you can use CRISPR to edit things that will fight the tumors, you know, the tumors or fight the cancerous cells. You can also use CRISPR to detect them. I mean, one of the problems with cancer is sometimes you don't know until it's too late. But if you have these testing kits with CRISPR that can detect any genetic material, then you could every, you know, morning do your little test and make sure that you don't have. And then you can sequence the tumors so that you know this is the tumor that I'm fighting. This is the cancer I'm fighting. It's very personalized to me. But I can have a personalized CRISPR treatment that is designed, that's encoded to go after that. So I think it'll be a big deal for cancer in the next 5 to 10 years.
Do you think also it would be a big deal? It's going to help pharmaceutical companies as well, because they can come up with medications and treatments and protocols that can fight very specifically. Like I remember years ago when they first came out with Gleevec, right? That was those hard-encased brain tumors where they knew that the Gleevec could penetrate and disarm that, basically. And so now they know specifically then what they're looking at, instead of, you know, sometimes we just throw everything at it and hope something works and you end up killing everything around it. Do you think this is going to help pharmaceutical companies?
This is the era. This is the new era we're entering, a very personalized medicine where we can code, you know, the vaccine to go after exactly what we want. Or we can encode a piece of RNA to chop up whatever we want to chop up in our system, or create whatever protein we want to create in our system. And we can sequence. You know, cancer is not a disease. Cancer is, you know, hundreds of thousands of different cells that are running out of control in different ways. If you can sequence that and you can have a way to target that genetic material specifically, that brings us to a new era of medicine.
This is a really interesting question by Judy Wade, because you do talk a little bit about the labs and the rivalries and everybody moves around. And she says, places like UC Berkeley, which are incredible engines of both innovation, third in Nobel Prizes, and access to first gen and first to college students, are under threat with state budget cuts. So how can we convince wealthy donors to give to places like Cal rather than continuing to create mega endowments at elite private colleges that don't need more money?
Well, I don't want to get in trouble with private colleges, including Tulane, where I work.
Right.
I think that anybody donating money to any institute of higher learning, it's a good thing, especially if it's a research university that's fighting these things. I think also we shouldn't put this is my own personal view, it shouldn't just be on philanthropy to do it. I mean, the reason Berkeley is absolutely wonderful, or was, is because Abraham Lincoln way back does the land grant act, and that sort of the roots of the University of California, Berkeley, is when those, you know, colleges that in the 1860s and 70s are coming along. So this is what's made America great, is publicly funded research universities that used to be incredibly inexpensive, you know, very low tuition for in-state students, and now are very expensive. And yeah, it would be nice if philanthropists wanted to give to LSU as well as Tulane, or give to University of California, Berkeley, as well as to Stanford. But I don't think we should figure that's the solution. I think the solution is to go back to the way it's been for a century and a half, which is we make America strong by having publicly funded universities.
Jet says, what keeps a government from using this for devious means to control or manipulate their population, and who will eventually oversee this technology? And I guess we can add on to that. Do we need a global governing source like we have for internet, for we have for nuclear weapons? Do we need something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd trust a global governance source right off, but I think we should enlist like-minded governments to do things. You know, one of the largest funders of Jennifer Doudna's work at the University of California is the Defense Department, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And that's because they're creating, you know, or defending against foreign governments that would use CRISPR to create pathogens or mosquitoes or whatever that could be harmful. Or, as Putin said in a talk, and may use CRISPR to create better soldiers that are impervious to pain, that have more courage, that can resist radiation. So, in fact, one of the things that Jennifer's group has created, a guy named Joseph Bonomi, is called anti-CRISPR. It was funded by the Defense Department, which is how you reverse a gene edit if it's done by a hostile power or something. So, yeah, we're entering an age in which we have to fund some of this research for defense purposes as well.
Here's a question. Could the technology be used to create self-reproducing biologic computers?
Computers. No, I think, you know, I teach a course in the history of the digital revolution here at Tulane. There's a fundamental difference between organic life, you know, which is carbon-based wetware of our bodies and our brains, and silicon digital thinking. Yeah, I guess you could create a wetware analog computer someday that works within a carbon-based system. But I think the fundamental difference is, which is good, and this is why I'm not a believer that we're about to have artificial intelligence that will totally replicate humans, because I think for the time being, meaning the next century or so, binary digital on-off switches, you know, based in semiconductors, which is what computers are, have a fundamentally different approach than a wetware carbon-based human body and brain.
Here's an interesting question. Jim Nachbar asks, have there been religious world leaders, ethicists, or philosophers part of the discussion on the use of this incredible new tool?
Oh, yeah. Ever since the beginning of the discussions, I would say in the 1970s on gene engineering as well as gene editing, there's been a very strong theological component. And in my book, in fact, I think there's a section called Playing God, whether it's Paul Ramsey, the Protestant theologian. One of the great thinkers on it is Leon Cass from University of Chicago, a Jewish thinker who's written on the Old Testament, but is also a biologist with a PhD in biology. So there's sections in my book. I do think we can't just have the scientists figure this out. I think there is a room for the various ethical frameworks we use, religion foremost amongst them.
Aileen Pargament asks, is there any connection between stem cell research and treatments and RNA research and treatment?
Yes, as I said, when they do the treatment for sickle cell anemia on Victoria Gray, they take the stem cells from her body, which are the cells that produce the new blood cells and everything else, and they edit them with CRISPR. And so CRISPR can be used to edit stem cells, and stem cells are important because they can, you know, give birth to other types of cells.
And the last question I have for you, which somebody else has, is what book is next?
I don't really know yet. I've been asked that a lot, and I kind of usually take 6 months and kick around a whole lot of ideas. There are a lot of current people who are interested in the world of business, from Bill Gates to Elon Musk to Jeff Bezos, and I particularly admire Bill Gates for a lot of reasons, which you can imagine. There are historical figures like Marie Curie, who did win the Nobel Prize in chemistry even before Jennifer, but I'm taking my time.
We will wait with bated breath and look forward to that. So thank you so much. We appreciate it. And stay safe, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was biographer Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. He was joined in conversation by journalist Holly Furfer. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamitwan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.